popcorn, jock tops, phones away, comfy chairs. Also, overpriced tickets. So many ads. Everyone's back on their phones again. And popcorn. Why am I wearing so much popcorn? Damn it. Remember going to the movies? Remember when that was a thing? Well, this week on Download This Show is the combination of streaming services like Netflix and Disney Plus and COVID-19 going to be the final nail in the coffin of the big screen experience. Also, inside the world of contact tracing apps, Singapore have signed hundreds of thousands of their citizens up to a mobile app that will use their location data to help trace the coronavirus. But how does it work and what level of government surveillance are you comfortable with? Also on the show, churches, synagogues, mosques, temples, how are faith communities leading the way with building communities in the age of isolation? All of that and much more coming up. This is your guide to the week in media, technology and culture. My name is Mark Fennell and welcome to Download This Show. Yes, indeed, it is a brand new episode of Download This Show for this remarkably weird era that we are living through. Joining me from, I'm guessing, your living room, Ariel Bogle. Tell me where you are right now.
That's right. It's a mixture between living room and dining room, I'd have to say.
Is there anything on the dining room table?
Just the mic.
Just the microphone. And joining us, newly returned to Australia after a sojourn. That's a word. In the UK, advertising, I'm going to go with guru. That's what I'm going to go with. Advertising guru, journalist and writer, Jono Seidler, or Jonathan, as his grandmother calls him. Welcome back to Download This Show.
Thanks, Mark. I'm in my baby sister's room because I'm back at home with my mum because I wasn't allowed to go anywhere when I got back from the UK. So that's where I am. So if you see lots of strange art, it's not mine. It's a 15-year-old girl's.
Likely story.
Likely story.
I mean, that's what I would say if I were you. There are so many different parts of the media and technology industry that are being affected by the crisis that shall not be named. And one of the ones I wanted to focus on today was the movie business. In the last couple, we mentioned it briefly at the end of last week's show, but I think it's worth exploring in more detail because the movie business has been changing pretty drastically over the last few years with the rise of streaming companies and a greater push to collapse the window between when a movie comes out at the cinema and when it comes out on a streaming service. So does the rise of COVID-19, does it actually kill that window, Jono Seidler?
I'm not really sure it does. From what I've seen, there's maybe like one major studio, which I believe is Universal, who are trying to push. I think they pushed Trolls earlier, Trolls World Tour, or I believe it was called. Not that I saw it because this is not my bedroom. but from what I understand, they pushed that one earlier, but they had separate reasons kind of outside of COVID-19 for doing that. But like Universal are quite renowned for trying to shut that window down and push into streaming earlier. And the major theater chains in the US are quite upset with them about it, to put it lightly. But everybody else seems to be respecting that convention, I guess, in the traditional sense, and just moving their release dates further on. It doesn't look like those windows are necessarily shrinking at the moment.
But Ariel, at the same time, we now have big media companies that once upon a time would have relied on theatre releases. I'm thinking particularly of Disney here, who actually own a direct relationship with their customers by way of Disney Plus. And so, for example, you've got that new animated movie Onward, which has Chris Pratt in it, which was obviously supposed to be a big sort of animated theatrical release, which is now going pretty much straight to Disney Plus. Do you think one of the unintended effects of maybe COVID-19 is the fact that it's going to become a lot easier for those big companies to skip out that theatrical middleman?
I think we're all waiting to see how this plays out in the long term. And it also really depends on how long we're confined to our homes for the most part. I mean, even Paramount has moved one of its releases, I think it's called Lovebirds, to Netflix early because it wants people to see it. But all the measures of success for films, you know, those first box office weekends, awards, those only happen when things are released in cinema. So there's a lot of incentives going on here for things to return to the status quo when we're all let out. And I'm not sure in the long term how much this will push streaming, but I certainly see that for the most part and for the moment, places like Netflix are the winners here.
See, that's an interesting idea, Ariel, this idea that when this thing, and I'm saying when because, dear God, I need to believe it's a when this thing finally ends, that there'll be like a reflex reaction that we want to go out to things like theatres and move out. Is that a thing that you think is likely to happen?
Well, certainly personally, I love going to the cinema and I have immense cabin fever right now, so I personally cannot wait. I think a lot of people do love streaming, you know, and they are enjoying getting those releases that they thought they'd have to go to the cinema for early. But there's a lot of things getting pushed back. I'm sure people are aware James Bond's release date's pushed back. I think a lot of these studios are saving those premium properties for some day, some blessed day in the future when we can go see them in the cinema. Will they put those premium products on Netflix? Like, it really does seem like it would affect their brand long term.
I think Bond is such a cinematic franchise, if we are talking about that. Like, I would, and a number of people that I know would only see that in the cinema. It's almost like it's designed for that. The amount of money they sink into that, and I read a figure somewhere where they were saying it's like, how are you going to get $2.7 billion return, which is what the last Avengers brought in box office takings from streaming when everyone's paying $9 or $10 a month. Like, you've pretty much got to have the whole world watching it consistently for a year or something. I don't even know what those numbers are, but it's insane. So you do need to have it, but it's also that idea of all being together in the cinema. There are certain tentpole releases which don't only rely on that, but I almost think like we rely on it as well as a cultural event. And yeah, we've got Tiger King on Netflix, but it's it's not really the same as all being in the cinema or seeing Bond at the same time. But also in terms of what we look at critically with films. So if you think about all of the film festivals that have been put on hold, like South By and Tribeca and all the rest of those, but also the way that we judge films, how critics judge films, whether that's going to collapse now that everybody's seeing films at the same time. You know, I saw a food reviewer the other day having to review food that he got takeout from Good Food, where he put it all together in his own home, which I don't think he's done in like 25 years. So that whole template is changing, and it's really going to be interesting how we react to it, but also how the cinematic world reacts to it. I mean, like, agencies like Paradigm aren't killing off all of their agents. Sorry, not killing off. letting go of killing off is a really horrible way of saying it. Letting go of so many of their agents because they've still got Netflix receipts. You know what I mean? They need that whole economy really does rely on those tentpole releases, I think.
I'm really fascinated by the economy of celebrity in general. Like, it's a bit harder to measure, but what will this do to celebrity big picture long term? You know, if you don't have premieres, if you don't have the Oscars because no films came out of the cinema this year, you know, where does their cachet, where does their cultural impact come from? Is it just from Instagram Lives?
I was just going to say Instagram Lives of them cooking or doing cocktails or doing bad solo covers of songs.
Could be the Webbies.
Well, actually interestingly, well, yes. Also the Webbies has been pushed back as well. So if you aren't familiar, the Webby Awards is the peak award for internet culture. It covers videos, podcasts, a lot of advertising as well. And even their nominations for this year have been pushed back.
There's a great essay in the New York Times this week from Amanda Hiss looking at the celebrity live videos that we just mentioned and sort of unpacking them, because a lot of the time they're attempts at heartwarming material from various celebrities in their Aspen mansions or their Santa Monica beach houses. It's not really appropriate for the moment because a lot of us are just stuck in apartments or, you know, places without beautiful vistas and pools and cooks. And so there's an element of class discomfort that comes in here if this goes on, and we don't really see the point of a celebrity unless they're creating or wearing beautiful outfits in the tabloids, if you know what I mean.
I saw David Geffen was on his super yacht in the Grenadines and he's like, just waiting out COVID-19. I was like, thanks, mate.
I don't know. Some of that art behind you looks pretty bougie.
You can't see it yet.
No, I can't. I'm hoping to God this works as a sight gag because I have no evidence to back me up.
I mean, it could.
It is worth pointing out that there's a pretty thick swathe of content that once upon a time, maybe in the 90s and the early 2000s, would have gone onto big screens. It's already moved to streaming. So adult-ish dramas and documentaries almost entirely moved onto streaming. I guess the question is whether or not this big crisis can affect
what was traditionally the sort of film that would have worked, which is basically franchise blockbusters and kids entertainment, because a lot of the big kid stuff like your Frozen 2s and stuff like that still do great, incredible business at the big screen. I would say my early prediction is that the kid stuff is going to move faster than the franchise stuff. What do you think?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I mean, especially at the moment, given all these kids at home with parents who are trying to work at the same time, any new content that comes that might have once been going to the cinema now on streaming platforms is just going to be embraced with open arms. But I think the studios, once this ends, will still be after those big cultural moments that can only come from a premiere where people are there in physical space. So certainly the Marvels and the DCs, I think we can expect a return to the cinema. But when it comes to those sort of more indie films or more adult dramas, I think there is an open question about for their future in cinema, especially if the studios see an embrace of them on streaming platforms. But at the same time, as we've discussed already, like, there's no measure of success for streaming. Like, who? Tiger King is certainly the biggest cultural phenomenon documentary, the only thing that's being talked about apart from the coronavirus. But we still don't actually know how many people watched it.
It's funny because there was obviously that Sean Parker experiment a couple of years ago where he was trying to get people to pay a certain amount to watch a film as it was at home, kind of like as you would see it in the cinema, and you'd pay a real premium, but you pay per film. That's so if funny. You wanted to see Bond in your home cinema, you'd watch it at home. And that kind of collapsed for a number of reasons. But I wonder if, given what's happening now with social distancing and how long that's going to take, whether that will have a resurgence.
When that idea first came up, I do just remember thinking, this is really smart and it feels like a matter of time. And the theatre owners had so much skin in the game and they had so much power to be able to stop it from moving forward. That is no longer a component. Like, they have no power in the current environment. I just wonder whether or not a project, if not that or something like that, might actually find its time if it were to launch in the next, 6 weeks.
It's an interesting idea. I just wonder in the end how much people will pay for a one-off film. Obviously, you can buy or rent a film on iTunes. Price point is, you know, usually pretty low. But if it's a Bond, are you going to pay $50? Would you pay $50 to see Bond at home?
Just depends how desperate I get. Download This Show is what you're listening to. It is your guide to the week in media, technology and culture. And we are relying a great deal on media and technology at the moment in the current crisis. Speaking of, one of the countries that's been lauded for how they've handled coronavirus and COVID-19 has been Singapore. An interesting thing that launched towards the end of March in Singapore is a tracking app called Trace Together that was designed to help track the spread of novel coronavirus. About 620,000 people signed up within a week. But I'm curious to actually understand what it does, Ariel. What does it actually do?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, a lot of people in Singapore have voluntarily chosen to download this app. And essentially what it does is put a bit of software on their phone that when it comes into proximity of another person with that same software on their phone, it'll make a note of that. But apart from that, it is fairly anonymous, or it says it's fairly anonymous. It doesn't really record your location in the long term. It's mainly intended so that if you do get sick or you've been in contact or close proximity, say like in an elevator or standing next to somebody in a line, that the government or the healthcare workers can go back and find you and tell you to quarantine.
I will also make the observation that I think it's one of the things you might only be able to do in a place like Singapore, where I say this as a person that's half Singaporean, the relationship between civil liberties and government obedience in Singapore are very different to what you might expect in Australia. Do you think this is the sort of thing that could have been used in other places, Ariel?
So it's an open question about whether a similar app would go down well in other countries. As you've mentioned, Singapore has if not a trusting relationship with their government, at least one where they're slightly more willing to put essentially a government tracking app on their phone. I'd be interested to see what the reception to something similar would be here in Australia. I think people are open to having this discussion at the moment. Certainly it's sort of taking off in the media, and there have been some level of tracking here taking place. I know in South Australia back in February, a couple was tracked using their phone data after they had been diagnosed with the novel coronavirus to see where they'd gone. But if this was large scale, federal government tracking, I think people might have some questions about that, because obviously at the end of the day, It is a form of surveillance in the name of public health, of course, but will there be a sunset clause? When will this tracking be done with?
And I think that speaks to a larger issue, Jono, about how our relationship with, I guess, civil liberties and our relationship with government and government ordinance is really changing at the moment. But just to focus on that point about privacy, I mean, what kind of assurances does this tracking app give people for their privacy, Jono?
Not a huge deal, but there is a relationship of trust, as Ariel mentioned. It's interesting, we were talking about other countries as well, where we think this might be coming in. I have a couple of friends in Israel at the moment who were some of the first people to be locked down and unable to leave the country. And Israel's got quite a sophisticated tracking system with regards to this kind of thing. They can kind of alert people in an area if somebody else who has been diagnosed with coronavirus has been in that area, even if that person hasn't actually authorized that information to be given over to the authorities. So it is kind of like touch and go, depending on what happens in which country.
And there was a backlash to that in Israel, right?
Huge. But there's kind of nothing they can do about it. Their laws are sort of set up that way. And I think that that's what I think is going to be an issue with Australia, is that from what I've been reading, and I've got to do a bit more work on it, but the Telecommunications Act actually allows for the Australian government to have quite a similar relationship with our metadata, should they desire to. So we've really got to be quite careful about what we allow and what we don't allow from a civil liberties perspective.
And I think that's a conversation that has really begun in earnest in the last couple of days, especially as some of our outdoor movement has been pretty significantly curtailed. I think there is now suddenly starting to be this conversation about, all right, well, we know obviously there are things that we need to change in the name of public health, but where is that line? Where are we comfortable with that line? Are we communicating to the public what that line is? And I think that's one thing to have a conversation in terms of whether or not you can have two people in a park. I think it's a very different conversation when you talk about your data, because already our starting point behind where we even think about how much of our data is out there is so behind the eight ball, Ariel.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, of course, Australian metadata is already stored for 2 years and accessible by law enforcement. So there is that pool there, I suppose, waiting to be looked at if the authorities decide that's where they want to go. It was interesting, though, because this question was actually put to Scott Morrison earlier this week about whether Australia would be looking at using telecommunication data for contact tracing. And he quite vehemently pushed back on that and said, that wasn't really for Australia. That's not something that would happen here. It'll be interesting to see if he holds firm on that position as this progresses, because I think at the moment people are quite clear where the infection has come from. It's usually people having returned from overseas, coming back to Australia. But if we start to see higher levels of just community, you know, people that have not left Australia, just community infection, and we're not really clear about where it's coming from, I think there might be more pressure to investigate these kinds of options.
Plus, it's not like governments change their mind all the time anymore.
Yeah, but there's also about community reporting, right? I mean, I am one of those people who came back from overseas. I went straight to a hospital to get tested. And then I was asking at the hospital, I was like, who is going to have access to this information? Am I going to be consulted before this information is shared with other people? And it was quite clear that nobody had the answers. Mm-hmm. And weeks later, still nobody has the answers. And that kind of, as we're changing the laws around where that you can be in the park with three other people, the laws around who has access to the information about my medical testing is also changing. And I'm a bit worried, because I just remember when there was the Boston bombing, and all of the Reddit users of Boston had decided that they had found out who the Boston bomber was. Do you remember? And they all went after some guy, and it turns out that it wasn't actually that guy at all.
Yeah.
And what happens when you start getting that information out, A, to police forces, but to whoever wants to have access to that, is that we can create a society-wide condition where everybody thinks that they can report on everybody else. People can start dobbing in their neighbours, which can work, obviously, in instances where it needs to, but can also be really, really used in bad ways.
Yeah, and the whole concept of dobbing in people is a complicated one, because you can see that going awry in about 14 different ways.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. I think in Korea, actually, they've been more open about who exactly has had an infection, you know, where they might live, what workplace they were in, to a level that we haven't yet seen in Australia. There's been, you know, a pretty good level of anonymity for the moment maintained about who's been diagnosed. But yeah, as Jono mentioned, as this goes on, people are, you know, say the rate of infection started to slow, we were let out of our house, but then it came back in certain pockets of the country. I think there might be a temptation there about shaming people, or, you know, what kind of person is spreading this now. So I think even if we brought in some sort of level of telecommunication tracking or identification of people using their technology, as I mentioned before, we'd need to have some sort of sunset clause in there or some sort of protection if community situation or community sentiment changes.
Download This Show is what you're listening to. It is your guide to the week in media, technology and culture. Mark Fennell is my name. And I'm joined remotely by Jono Seidler. He's a journalist. He's a writer. He comes from the world of advertising. And Ariel Bogle is technology writer with the ABC's Science Unit. And we spent a lot of time talking about what separates us. We're obviously all three of us in different isolated locations today. But throughout that, there are all these interesting ways in which people are coming together. And one of the areas I thought was particularly fascinating is how people are coming together around the area of faith. How are churches, mosques, how are synagogues, how are people doing that community in an isolated way? And there's been all these interesting examples of technology playing a role there. Jono, what are the different things you're seeing in terms of how faith communities are connecting in this environment?
Well, it's an interesting one for me. I was supposed to be getting married on Sunday. So I was meant to be having a traditional Jewish wedding, which requires 10 men, which is otherwise noted as a minyan. And interestingly, we've got rules around weddings, which has now been limited to 5 people. So that would make that impossible. So what we're seeing for people like me, and obviously the more orthodox parts of my community, you've got sort of like Zoom collectives where people are able to come together and get those 10 people. I mean, we've got Passover, obviously in line with Easter for those of the Christian faith. We've got Passover coming up next week. That's usually when I go to my grandparents' house with my uncles and my aunts, and we all sit around the table. That's also going to be conducted remotely. I'm going to be sending a laptop over to my grandparents' house and hoping to God they know how to use it.
They don't. Let me tell you now, they do not.
They're all right with YouTube. But you know, it is interesting, and every faith is doing things differently. Obviously, Mecca and Medina are closed down if you're from the Islamic faith, and you've got stuff like pray.com, which is like a massive database for the Christian community. And everybody's kind of interacting in different ways. But I think certain faith-based areas or certain people from certain faiths have always had technology as part of their offering. So preachers in particular, whether those are, I guess, rabbis at synagogues or whether those are Christian preachers who lead their flock, for lack of a better word, have always turned to YouTube and services like that to be able to spread their message. Podcasting has been big for ages. It's just about consolidating that all for people who perhaps never really thought about using it.
Yeah, I, for reasons that are too confusing to explain, I follow lots of different people of different faiths on Instagram, and I end up watching a lot of religious content that I don't know why. It's just there in my scrolling feed.
Plus has expired.
Yeah. When you run out of Frozen content, you go to Hillsong content. I don't know. But it's been interesting to watch. I found it fascinating to watch how those particular communities have reacted to it. And there has been actually, Ariel, quite a bit of writing, and particularly about pray.com, which has actually been around for a really long time, as I understand it, Ariel.
Yeah, that's right. There's actually a lot of Christian apps that have been around a long time. There's a pretty popular Bible app as well, I understand. But pray.com, it's an app you can sign up to, and then you can listen to podcasts from different preachers or priests and things. You can listen to sort of bedtime Christian stories or have Bible passages read to you. It's very interactive. And as Jono said, I think a lot of these faiths have been preparing for this in a way for a long time.
Would you say end of times?
They've been praying for the end of times. It's kind of in the book, you know.
They had a warning.
Had a warning. They knew it was coming, so they're ready. I think the key thing, though, is those sort of moments of gathering, you know, whether it is a wedding or it's a Shabbat service. I think it's the older people in the faith potentially who have the most to lose at the moment, because those are really moments of community. So we've seen Zoom groups, you know, start up, live stream mass for people on Instagram, you know, everyone's seizing the moment, I would say.
I think the other thing is also, not to be cynical about it, but a lot of the financial gains that you can get as the leader of a community, or if you run a synagogue or a church, comes from people being there. it's tithing, it's, you know, high holidays if you're Jewish. It doesn't matter what you are. A lot of that is coming from donations in the site, so they need to be able to digitize that as well.
I think that's become quite well developed, if I'm being diplomatic, particularly with some of the bigger churches, I've noticed.
Sure. And I mean, on pray.com too, I believe there are in-app purchases. So I wonder if we'll see a movement to kind of app monetization of different religions over time. I mean, I think a lot of evangelical faiths have already gone online, are pretty savvy there, and are pretty savvy about tithing, you know, collecting those funds from their community. I think it'll be interesting to see how other faiths adapt if they need to.
Also, how secular communities react as well. Like, I'd be fascinated to know if there are lessons that can be learned from how faith communities are operating on the internet that perhaps other groups, you know, that are not based in a faith, like something as simple as, you know, neighbourhood groups or mothers groups or when you've just had a baby, are there lessons that can be schools? I mean, school communities is another one as well. Are there lessons that you can see could be taken from those pre-existing faith communities that could be ported into other spaces?
That's a great question. I think we've seen already a huge movement online, on Facebook, on WhatsApp groups, to provide not just help, you know, grocery shopping during this crisis, but also some level of spiritual support. I mean, personally, I've seen on Facebook friends who I'd never have expected to be into this kind of thing, setting up sort of meetings on Zoom once a week to just check in with people around mental health and sort of spiritual practice, you know, completely secular. So I think it will be interesting to see if that, as long as this goes on, how that plays out. But of course, like as just with any online group, you need to be wary of, you know, setting some ground rules, I suppose, because in faith communities and secular communities, online discourse can go off the rails pretty fast.
Yes. And I will also say that no one yet has done a full-blown exorcism on the internet. And if somebody wants to send me a video of that, I would watch it and share it.
I think that's definitely something that I'll look into. But in the interim, what I was also going to say is that I think for a lot of people, and this is perhaps a bit of a generalization, but generally across the culture, digital has been seen as slightly like a bit of a dirty word in terms of like you could just read a book or you could just go to the cinema or you could just do this. And now that it's kind of been taken away from a lot of people, I think like we're seeing an embrace of the digital in a way that it can't be separated as other. So like a good example is like my mum used to play cards with her friends and she's just downloaded like a Mahjong app. Like that app was there for 10 years. It was not going anywhere, right? But suddenly she's like, have you heard that I can get Mahjong as an app? I was like, of course you can. You can get everything as an app. You could like, you know what I mean? You could book a rocket ship on an app. But it's only now that it's becoming more acceptable for general use of everyday kind of community stuff that ordinarily would have been seen face to face.
I would like to know more about your rocket ship app personally.
It's up there with the exorcism.
All right. That idea for a topic came from Jeremy in Mooney Ponds, who hit me up on Instagram DMs. If you have something that you would like explored on the show, particularly how technology and the media is interacting with this new reality that we're living through, you can hit me up on Instagram, on Twitter, or on Facebook. I'd love to explore more of the ideas that are affecting you at the moment. A huge thank you to Ariel Bogle, our technology reporter with the ABC Science Unit. Thank you for talking to us from your lounge room / dining room.
Thanks, Mark.
And Jono Seidler, thank you for talking to us today.
My absolute pleasure.
Also, I want to say mazel tov for the wedding.
Well, I mean, you can't because it's not happening for the moment, but you can in a few months.
What's the word for I'm so sorry, this sucks?
That's exactly it. You
okay,
just said
cool.
It.
Well, you know, congratulations in waiting then. And with that,
thank you.
Name has been Mark Fennell, and thank you for listening to another episode of Download This Show.